everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party candidate for president in 2020. And this is Green Socialist Notes, a podcast where we talk about continuing to advance the issues and policies that Angela Walker and I campaigned on in 2020. And I don't have my light on. It's so cold here. It was 7 below 0 when I got up. It just got above zero last time I looked, 1 degree. So maybe that's why that light isn't working. So I'm kind of in a shadow, but welcome. Today, we have a guest. Her name is Kristen Urquiza, who has been advocating for better workplace protections and support for families during the pandemic, including especially families that have lost loved ones. And you may have seen her. She spoke at the Democratic National Convention about Trump's bad advice, getting her father killed by COVID. And now she's organizing to put pressure on the Biden administration for better protections. So she'll be on in just a few minutes. Today is Martin Luther King's birthday, January 15. I know we celebrated this year on Monday, but I think we ought to remember him. I have an article that I wrote a couple years ago. The link to it should go up in the chat. And it's basically about how radical Martin Luther King Jr. was. He was a socialist. He was a militant in his nonviolent actions. You know, he was not just lobbying and begging. He was, by nonviolent direct action, as he explained in a letter to Birmingham Jail, trying to create a crisis so the system had to deal with the issue. And he was also an advocate of reparations. That was right there in his I Have a Dream speech. The I Have a Dream part was ad-libbed. It's a thing he had preached before. Mahalia Jackson, you know, told him after he'd finished his prepared remarks, tell him about the dream. So he did that. And that's what we remember. But if you go through the text, you'll see we're here to collect a promissory note. And we being African-Americans in particular, but poor people in general. And so that article is about that. And I hope you'll take a look at that. And of course, King and the Black Freedom Movement and the Civil Rights Movement was very concerned with voting rights. And that was a big issue this week. The Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act were merged at 6 o'clock. At least that's when the bill dropped Wednesday night, and by 10 a.m. Thursday morning, if I have my days right. No, it was Friday morning, Thursday and then Friday. They had voted on what's now called the Freedom to Vote : John R. Lewis Act. And that passed the House. Now it goes to the Senate, where it's going to die, because as Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin have made clear, but they're out in front of a bunch of other Democratic senators along with the Republicans, Coons, Hansen, Warner, Tester, you know, they really don't want to get rid of the filibuster, even if it's a way, even temporarily. They got rid of it to lift the debt ceiling, but they don't seem to want to get rid of it to protect the vote and protect elections. So the Senate is going to debate and vote on it Tuesday. The purpose seems to be to get people on the record with respect to filibuster reform, because they're not going to get to the substance of the Freedom to Vote : John R. Lewis Act. So it's now about campaign messaging for 2022, it looks like. And the Democrats are going to say we're for voting rights and election protection, and the Republicans are opposed. But, you know, why did it take so long for the Democrats to put this at the top of the list? They spent the whole year talking about a Build Back Better and the infrastructure, and before that, the COVID relief. And I think the progressives overestimated their strength. You know, there may be a partisan majority, but there's not an ideological majority for the kind of reforms that were proposed. So it's, you know, especially in retrospect, it looks like they overreached and might have been able to get some lesser things passed if they hadn't tried to, you know, go so big when they didn't really have the support in the Democratic Party. So this is going to be a messaging issue in 2022, and I think Greens need to pick up the mantle for inclusive democracy and expand what it means. Yes, it means ease of voting measures, like no excuse absentee balloting, making sure every precinct has enough voting stations so that people aren't waiting all day to get in and vote. But it should also mean candidate access to the ballot as well as voter access to the ballot, which is a big issue for Greens. We have a problem getting on the ballot because this country's ballot access laws are probably the most restrictive of any developed country electoral democracy in the world. So inclusive democracy means not just voting rights or ease of voting provisions, but fair ballot access laws. There should be a federal standard for federal elections. Ranked choice voting for executive offices so people can vote for who they want without worrying about the spoiler effect and helping their worst enemy. And then proportional representation in legislative bodies so that all political viewpoints get their fair share of representation. And of course, the Greens, who are pretty much excluded, except we have over 100 local elected officials, but in state legislatures and Congress. And when you look at the polls, you know what Angela and I ran on, Green New Deal, Medicare for All, student debt relief, majorities of people support this. And Trump and Biden were opposed. But given the two-party system and single member district plurality voting, which is an exclusionary system, we don't get the representation that is proportional to the support our policies have. So I hope Greens, as they run for not just Congress, but state legislative offices this year, raise those issues. And the other thing I think it's worth pointing out is that voter suppression obviously is bad because it makes it harder to vote, particularly for the Democratic-leaning constituencies the Republicans are targeting, racial minorities, young people, and so forth. But party suppression is bad too. And, you know, that's what authoritarian governments do. It's not just the Democrats who try to suppress the Greens. You know, they try to blame Jill Stein for 2016, but we have exit polling showing that 61% of her voters would not have voted if she wasn't on the ballot. And you plug that number into the close states in 2016, and it means her vote falls well below the margin of difference in states like Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. On the other hand, the Libertarian candidate in 2020, a lot of people give her credit for getting Biden elected because she had well over the margin of difference in five battleground states, Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. And so the Republicans have an interest in making it hard to get on the ballot too. So this is something we got to fight both parties on. But while voter suppression is bad and party suppression is bad, we now got another issue that we got to deal with, and that is the danger of stolen elections, because the Republicans right now are purging nonpartisan election officials, like, you know, Black election officials in Georgia on county boards of election. They're violently, in some cases, intimidating election administrators. So a lot of people who have been election administrators saying, I've had enough of this, they're quitting. And the Republicans are trying to move in to take control of vote counting and certification so they can steal elections. They got this big lie out there that Trump had the election stolen from him, but they're actually setting it up so they can do it in the states. So we need federal legislation for election protection. So ballot access, ranked choice voting, proportional representation, election protection. We need to be, as Greens, campaigning for those things, as well as making it as easy as possible for people to who are legitimately qualified to cast votes. So I think that's going to be a big issue in 2022. The Democrats have blown it this year, and so it's time for the Greens to step up. And then the other big issue this week is, you know, this explosion of COVID cases and the fact that workers in a lot of occupations have been going on job actions. There's some nonsense out there by people, the anti-vax crowd, that say they're striking against vaccine mandates. It's not the case. These job actions are about getting better protection at work. And this is in a context where big business, the leaders of both corporate parties and commercial media, are pushing them to go back to work. They want people to go, you know, to work to die for working because they want to get the economy going. So we've seen teachers and in many cases students in Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Oakland, Seattle, Portland, Baton Rouge, Boston, and other cities, doing sick outs or refusing to go, like in Chicago, although they now have an agreement with the mayor for better protections. In New York City, there was a protest led by my former running mate for lieutenant governor in New York, Gia Lee, to get better protections for the teachers. You know, they want quality masks, they want comprehensive testing, and they want better ventilation. So that's why they've gone out. We've had job actions at fast food retailers, a pizzeria in Austin, the Starbucks in Buffalo that recently voted for a union. And then the nurses, you know, the National Nurses United took action this week in a dozen states. Again, they're demanding more personal protective equipment, PPE, better ventilation, and for the nurses, better staffing ratios. And this is in a context where the support for families during the pandemic has been expiring. We lost supplemental unemployment benefits in September. The CDC's eviction moratorium expired in October. New York City had an extended moratorium. It expires today. And we already know that in many cases, even when the moratorium was there, judges in these housing courts have been siding with the landlords, despite these, the federal moratorium and in some cases city moratoriums. And then the child tax credit just expired this week. So while the pandemic continues and we have record cases, hospitalizations, and deaths as we speak, the supports for people have been pulled away. And then the other issue, which, you know, we raised in a press release a couple of weeks ago, is vaccine apartheid. The Moderna and Pfizer have used their patents to extract monopoly profits while not letting the poorer countries get access to these vaccines. The patents should be lifted and the vaccines should be produced so that people in the global South can get vaccinated, because if they're not, COVID spreads through those populations and we get new variants like Omicron that we're dealing with right now. So this remains a crisis, and Omicron may be peaking and on the way down. That's what we're hearing in the news, like it did in South Africa and the UK, although we, you know, should be cautious until we really see that. But another variant could come, and is likely to come, because most of the world isn't vaccinated. So this is an issue that's ongoing, which is why I'm so glad that Kristen Urquiza came on today to talk about the work she's been doing, advocating for better worker protections. Continuing, she made that presentation, many of you may have seen, at the Democratic National Convention, but now she's organizing to put pressure on the Biden administration. And she's doing this work through an organization she created called Marked by COVID, which also is about helping the families that have lost loved ones. And so there she is. Welcome. And, you know, tell us about how you got into this advocacy and, you know, what you're doing and how viewers can get involved.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me here, Holly. I'm excited to have this conversation with you and chat with, you know, folks who are out there tuning in. I started Marked by COVID. It was, I think, 7 days after my dad passed from COVID-19 in June of 2020. Prior to that, I had just finished graduate school, had been focusing on developing my career around how to create equitable policy that centers people who've been, you know, most impacted and have systematically been left out of government and others places. And it was just this moment in my life where the state of Arizona had just reopened, encouraging people to get back into the economy and that it was safe. It was, the governor was on record multiple times saying, you know, if you don't have, you know, if you're not a sick person, you'll be fine. Go out, you know, live your life. And I think to people today, that's, you know, folks would laugh at that. But in late May, early June of 2020, it was a very different time. We still didn't know much about the virus, how it spread, you know, who it impacted more. And so my dad took that advice and got sick and ended up losing his life. And that whole experience of losing a loved one to COVID was unlike anything that I had ever experienced before. And I thought I knew what agony was. I thought I knew what pain and grief were, but not being able to be with my dad, not being able to get consistent updates on how he was doing. And then also seeing that in my, you know, low income, majority Latino, almost majority immigrant home community where my parents lived, people were waiting in line for upwards of 13 hours to get a COVID test. It really was showcasing what we've been saying all along about how this pandemic has really revealed, you know, the haves and everybody else. And I knew that I needed to speak out. And so that is what launched Marked by COVID, which is a nonprofit working to hold elected officials accountable all across the spectrum. We are nonpartisan, but also to help, as you said, Howie, to help families who have either lost loved ones or lost their health because of long COVID, find resources, community, and then also become advocates for this community and for a recovery that centers these values that we have, you know, that we collectively have of health equity, justice, and a political system that, you know, isn't run by just people who have access and privilege.
So I know one thing you're doing with Marked by COVID is, you know, helping and helping people remember and helping the families of people that have, you know, been lost to COVID. And I'm wondering if those pictures over your right shoulder are some of those people.
Yeah, this is just a very little reflection of some of the folks that have been lost to COVID, whose family members have submitted their pictures to be included in different memorials and memorial efforts. These folks in particular had joined us at the a vigil that we held outside the White House in late July, calling on the president and others to you know, prioritize memorializing and honoring our grief. But then also at that time, we were pushing the administration to you know, do more to provide for working families.
So I know you were supporting or part of a letter that was sent to Biden last week. Can you talk about, you know, what was in that letter and if you got a response?
Yeah, so great question. In addition to just helping families find a sense of healing and community, we work with people all across the country who want a better pandemic response to help pull people together in collective action. And so over the course of the last couple of months, we've been working with a group of public health professionals to circulate a letter to the Biden administration and the leader or the coordinator of the White House Coronavirus Response Task Force, Jeffrey Zients, who is in charge of making the decisions about the pandemic response. And, you know, that letter is centered around lowering barriers to access for the tools that our communities need to keep one another safe. So we really centered on a couple of things. One, making sure that folks have access to free rapid tests, free N95 masks, and have those mailed to people continuously so that we have an ample supply and can easily access those. But then also calling for OSHA and worker protection so that people who are being forced and don't have options but to work non-remotely have, you know, the protections needed to keep themselves, their families, and their communities safe. We haven't received a response from that letter, but we are, you know, not letting that deter us from having more people get involved and continue to pressure the White House to change its course. This is not the pandemic response that we were promised by the Biden administration. It was not the pandemic response that I campaigned for and why I went to the DNC to share my story. And it's not the pandemic response that we deserve. This idea right now of sort of what feels like just let it rip, let everybody get sick. That type of pandemic response is classist, it's racist, and it's ableist. There's so many people out there who are vulnerable, who are at higher risk of getting sick, and we're not doing our part to keep them protected. And that's a disgrace. And so that's what we're mobilizing to just be in solidarity with working people and workers who are really in a fight for their health and for their lives right now.
Yeah, I thought it was telling, and I can't remember exactly when she said it, but it was around Christmas time. Jen Psaki, who's the spokesperson for the Biden administration, was asked by a reporter, well, why don't you send tests out to everybody? Mm-hmm. And she said, what, for free to everybody? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, that's not our problem. And I'm concerned that we're hearing more and more from elected officials, including the Biden administration, and public health officials at the top, as well as the commercial media, that, you know, COVID is here to stay, so get used to it. And mm-hmm. it's very different than the idea, let's get everybody vaccinated and suppress the virus. You know, mm-hmm. should we get used to polio? Should we get used to smallpox? Mm-hmm. I'm just concerned they're retreating. And although I understand they're going to send out N95 masks to everybody, or they're going to send out tests to everybody. Mm-hmm. And N95 masks, I'm not sure what they're doing with that. But yeah, it seems, and we know that a lot of reporting that the CDC reduced the quarantine time for people who tested positive from 10 days to 5 days. Under pressure from business interests. I know that Sarah Nelson of the Flight Attendants Union, you know, complained bitterly about that. It just seems they, going back to where Trump was when he said, you know, we're going back to work, everybody go back to school, don't worry about COVID, it's just the flu or something. Mm-hmm. So
we are, you know, all of those points are not only true, but they underscore how we are creating a false choice between a strong economy and a healthy public. And we can actually, what the Biden administration has done is goes against public health guidance and experts, the people calling the shots on the task force. Jeffrey Zients, he's not even a public health person or a medical doctor, he's a businessman. You can tell by these courses of action is that the priority is to get people working at whatever cost, get people out of their houses. And that is just absurd whenever you think about what we know about this virus now. And also the things that we know that we don't know. One of the things that we talk about in Marked by COVID is not only the people who've lost loved ones, but the growing a number of people who are still experiencing illness after acute COVID, so long COVID, which people have, you know, there are many patients who have been sick for now almost a couple of years with post-viral illness. And post-viral illness is a really big issue that doesn't have a lot of public support behind. Some of the research that's come out has shown that, you know, anywhere on conservative estimates that 10 to 15% of people will have long COVID. If you think about that, those impacts on the workforce and who that's impacting the most, it really puts into context that prioritizing health is off the radar. It's all about this short-term wealth to try to demonstrate that we have beat the virus, gotten over the virus at any cost. And that's, yeah, that's not the country I want to live in. I do not want to live in a place where we're normalizing mass death. This is a humanitarian crisis. This is a mass disabling event. And we need our elected officials here and globally to step up to the plate and create solutions that are going to protect as many of us as possible.
Yeah, and I think people need to understand long COVID is serious. You know, for some people, it's lungs and, you know, shortness of breath forever. There's evidence it's affecting the brain, and some people are getting dementia from it. Mm-hmm. Any number of organs can be attacked. And so the idea that we need to, you know, give up suppressing it and just live with it, I think is, you know, not good for the people. Do you know how insurance companies are responding to requests for long COVID treatment?
It's a great question. It's, you know, what you would expect is that there it's all across the board right now. And what we're seeing is that not only are insurance companies, you know, kind of getting a little bit skittish around long COVID, but there are also doctors that call into question the validity of long COVID, working to downplay this mass disabling event. And whenever you think about it, we don't have the social system in place to provide a public option, you know, for people to have access to healthcare. Everyone should have healthcare. But here in the United States, we don't. So what are we going to do in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, when potentially upwards of, you know, 10 or 15% of the population is unable to work? These are serious questions that are not even being addressed, let alone acknowledged. And that doesn't even, you know, put into perspective the, you know, quality of life issues. People are struggling with their, you know, being able to just manage their day-to-day activities because long COVID can be so disabling. There's a lot of talk about self-harm in the long COVID community because of lack of recognition and lack of resources and lack of support. The long COVID community is calling for a task force at the administrative level to study and ensure long-term support to the long COVID community. But these are also folks that many of them haven't been able to work for a very long time. And then with the expiration of unemployment benefits and the other sort of band-aids that we had to help protect people during the beginnings of the crisis, these folks, we need to think about, how do we make sure that they remain housed? How do we make sure that they can send their kids to college? These are really important questions that we're not asking ourselves.
Yeah, and as I'm listening to you, I'm hearing you make the case for improved and expanded Medicare for all.
That's right.
We're going to need it going forward, and it shouldn't be a question of whether or not your insurance company will agree to cover your treatment. They have every interest in saying no so they can keep the premiums that are paid and the co-pays and so forth in their pockets. And anyway, that's
absolutely right though, Howie. And I'm glad that you put the fine point on that. Medicare for all has to come out of this. One sort of silver lining, I guess you could say, I just finished reading a book called Pale Rider, which is about how the 1918 pandemic changed the world. And it, you know, it was recommended to me by epidemiologists, and it was so eerie reading it, having just sort of being living through this pandemic and just the similarities that we're seeing. But that being said, one of the things that came globally out of the 1918 pandemic for most countries was a socialized healthcare system. So it's unfortunate that it may take something as monstrous as a pandemic to push the United States finally into that direction. But I know it's something that Marked by COVID, you know, stands for and will you know, work to ensure happens.
I'm looking at some of the comments in the chat, and a lot of people are complaining that there's a little anti-vax faction in the Green Party. Mm. And, you know, you got people that, you know, as far as I'm concerned, they've been hoodwinked by anti-vax grifters in the podcast realm into taking that position. And they can't tell the difference between evidence from public health departments and hospital reports about the effectiveness and safety of vaccines from the fact that, you know, Moderna and Pfizer produce them. So, you know, they're mad at Big Pharma. So they throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think there's a great article. I tweeted about it yesterday. It's by Joshua Frank at Counterpunch. It's up this weekend. And I put the link. It should come up on the chat here in a minute. I urge people to read it because he really takes down, you know, what's behind this. A lot of people are making money off the anti-vax movement, and they're posturing on the left when it has nothing to do with, you know, protecting the people and providing for the people. So that should come up there pretty soon, I hope.
It's heartbreaking to see just how effective the machine of dis and misinformation has been, and how it's been able to prey on, you know, a whole subset of the population and exploit you know, fears, many of which are grounded in very real experiences, both historically and present, to undermine the confidence of people getting a vaccine. And especially this vaccine, which, you know, wasn't developed overnight. if you look at the history of sort of having a blueprint ready to go, we were lucky in many respects that this particular, you know, viral virus came to light. But, you know, the history of dis and misinformation runs deep, and it goes exactly to what you just said. It's about the money. If you follow the money, you'll see there are, you know, folks making money off of this. And we don't have, you know, I remember this old saying that my mom or my grandma used to say about snake oil, like, you know, oh, you know, is that like a snake oil remedy? And you know, she grew up in the Depression. But, you know, it was this sort of heralding back to people, you know, have real questions about the overreach of medicine and people kind of trying to make a quick buck. And so when we've had so much lack of clear, decisive direction from both administrations on how to mitigate the pandemic, how to keep one another safe, like while it breaks my heart, I do understand that some people can be hesitant, but then I think it's really important that we have these types of conversations, hold, encourage, you know, conversations approaching with understanding, curiosity, to start to build back trust, because that is the key thing that's eroded.
Well, I'm seeing people are talking on the chat, and let's get some questions from there. While we're waiting for one to be put, oh, here's one right away. Long-term COVID, does it discriminate between vaxxed and unvaccinated?
That is a great question, Mark. Thank you for asking that. It does not. So two things on this. One, as we all know, COVID is still very new to us. We've only, you know, known about this for the last couple of years. So, and there hasn't been a ton of research, but what research does exist says that it does not discriminate between vaxxed or unvaxxed people, nor mild or severe cases, mild, severe, or asymptomatic cases. So there are people in the long COVID community who had COVID, were vaccinated, were asymptomatic, but are now experiencing, you know, brain fog, issues with executive function, you know, extreme exhaustion. These are all linked to long COVID. And so for me, in our community, you know, it's criminal that we're allowing this virus to rip through our communities, because the more people who get sick, it's not just the people who are going to pass, and that is a tragedy in and of itself, but it is the people who this virus will forever change their health. And we do not yet have the safety net to ensure that those people can live a life with dignity.
Jason Kaladny, anti-vax mandate is not anti-vax. Well, that's true by definition. The mandates discriminate against working class and the poor. The vax should be given to those who need it. The mandate is fascist. Let me start with a response. First of all, working class and poor people are trying to get access to the mandate. They are not doing job actions to stop vaccine mandates. They're doing job actions because they're not provided with PPE. They don't have social distancing in the workplace. The bosses are telling them to come back to work when they're sick. They are not, you know, providing public safety measures in the workplace. That's what the teachers and the nurses, and in the case of schools, students are going out for. That's what the flight attendants are talking about. What is fascist is the Republican efforts to suppress the vote, to purge election administrators of nonpartisan independent administrators so they can steal elections. The threat of fascism is from the right, not from vaccine mandates. You know, is it fascist that you have to stop at a red light? You know, is it fascist that kids have to have smallpox and polio and other vaccines to go to school, public schools? No. I mean, let's get clear about, you know, where the right is and what they're doing and not get lost in this. You know, and I have to say, most of the people that come out against the mandate were anti-vaccine people right all along. So anyway, Kristen, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I agree to that with all of what you just said, Howie. And just to uplift where you started at too, the people who are pushing back on their employers, they are in unsafe working conditions where they have been, in many cases, especially in places like schools, they've been promised high quality N95 or KN95 masks. They've been promised access to rapid testing and other different measures to help keep themselves, their colleagues, and their students safe. And the administration has not delivered on that. And a lot of times state laws have been put into place that, you know, require students to be in school for the school to be getting funding. So there are a lot of things kind of playing out right now that we are not doing everything in our possible to prioritize what is the priority here. And the priority here is, yes, of course we want to keep, yes, of course our children have had a really rough couple of years. But you know what's even worse than the last couple of years is having your teacher die from COVID or you yourself becoming chronically ill. We do have the tools necessary to help slow the spread, but we have to recognize here that the virus is first and foremost the enemy, and that our rules, our legislation, our policies aren't necessarily up to date to the way that they need to be. And we need to be doing everything in our power to ensure that students, teachers, workers have what they need to do their job safely. And we have the power to do that, but we're not delivering on it.
Yeah, and somebody's saying the mandates are right wing. You know, the right wing is using the mandates as a wedge issue. Mm-hmm. And they're giving libertarian arguments, which are kind of bogus. I mean, you know, are they saying you can drive on the left side of the road and not being able to is an impingement on your freedom? But they're using libertarian arguments for authoritarian consequences, because they're mobilizing people. But to, you know, kind of put a button on this one and maybe we'll get some other questions. I don't think that Josh Frank article got posted. I hope it can. I urge people to take a look at it. And, you know, he goes into basically the grifting by the anti-vax mandate people that call themselves on the left. But there's a lot of self-interest involved. Anyway, that's an article worth, it's up on Counterpunch this weekend by Josh Frank. I think it's called Vaccines, JFK Jr., and Misinformation. That's roughly the title. There it is. It's up in the chat now. Eric Gray, Kristen, as a public school teacher myself, what advice do you have for students in grades 6 to 12 about the world that we currently live in?
Well, Eric, first of all, I just want to say thank you for, you know, sticking in there and, you know, doing a very noble job that I'm sure you're not getting paid what you should be getting paid or have the support and resources that you need to be able to do the incredible job that your, you know, teachers do every single day. And, you know, I think about this a lot. You know, I was born in the 80s and grew up at a time when I thought that, you know, we had sort of evolved past, you know, the fight for civil rights. I remember learning about Martin Luther King Jr. I grew up in Arizona, so that was a really interesting place to grow up because we were one of the last states to ratify MLK's birthday as a holiday because of, you know, sort of the extreme right-wing racist folks that live in the state. So that being said, though, as a young person, I actually went into college being really angry because I felt like I had been tricked by the school system to believe that everything was okay when in fact everything wasn't okay. And so, you know, children, I think that they deserve the truth. I think that they deserve a truth in a way that meets them at their age, you know, where they're at, and also provides hope. And I think hope actually, for me, continually resides in the ability of for us to organize, whether it's within a union in a workplace to fight for your rights, or the students on high school campuses across the country that are distributing petitions to push back on the learning conditions that they have and are calling for a pause. I think that these big issues, especially in the United States that we struggle with, the most important gift that we can give the future generations are two things. One is the truth, you know, an accurate portrayal of history. And two is instilling in young people the self-respect to fight for their values and what they believe in. And I think organizing and speaking up is a really important tool for us to be, you know, instilling in young folks.
So I'm waiting for the next question. Here we go. Deborah Souza Oliveira, please don't overlook how much the pharmaceutical companies and Fauci made. We need real public education about virology and history of SARS and its origin, how it evolved, is it evolving because global climate change and our health care system and public health is degrading that allows for viruses like SARS to become a pandemic? I would personally like to know more about coronavirus evolution and what were the key factors for its appearance in 2019. Well, I would say all of us want to know more. There's, you know, they're still researching that. There's a lot of debate and a lot of speculation and conspiracy mongering about, you know, was it invented in a bio research lab in China? Is it a bioweapon, or did it come from bats via other animals in a Chinese wet market? There are all kinds of theories out there. And, you know, I don't think the science and the research has come to a definitive answer. I don't know what you got to say about it, Kristen.
Yeah, Deborah, I appreciate you raising this because one of the things that Marked by COVID, the organization I founded, is working for, is a nonpartisan, independent commission to fully investigate the pandemic, as well as the government's response, both within the Trump and the Biden administration. so that we can learn, get answers. I mean, there will probably be more questions than answers, but also have the receipts so that we can hold elected officials and others accountable for, you know, any, you know, bad intentions, bad actions. You know, the people who we've lost in this pandemic, that's the very least that we owe it to them to be able to know, learn from this and pass on to future generations the infinite wisdom of our lived experience. You know, I think a lot about how it is so important to me that, you know, if I live to be an old woman, to be able to look at the history books and have this chapter of history be more than the sentence that I read about the 1918 pandemic.
Mark Listrud, would the different strains of vaccines create variants?
So on this, no. The variants are created because the virus has an opportunity to mutate inside of its host. Mutations, viruses are basically super simple, tiny microscopic, you know, bugs, if you will, that I've learned a lot about viruses too over the course of the last couple of years. And I thought I knew a little bit, but I've learned even more. Scientists don't even know exact if, you know, there's a camp of scientists who even sort of question, well, are they even alive because they need a host in order to reproduce themselves to be able to basically biologically exist. So, you know, viruses are so interesting, but one of the things that makes viruses so dangerous is that because of their simplicity, they are able to mutate really easily. Mutations is what causes variants, and mutations occur in hosts. So as I was saying a second ago, the likelihood is that we will have other variations, other variants. And the likelihood is if we continue to allow cases to skyrocket, that's where those variants will come from. There are, you know, there is a probability that a very dominant variant could come that is, you know, actually better for us. But there's also the probability that a variant could come that is worse for us. And from a biological perspective, the imperative to stay alive, it's in the virus's best interest to mutate in a way that it outsmarts human beings. That is a huge reason why, as Howie was saying at the top of the hour, we need to ensure the world has access and can get vaccines. As long as we have this vaccine inequity globally, the virus has the opportunity to mutate. And as we saw with the Omicron variant, sometimes that becomes very transmissible.
Emil Sachs, I have to ride mass transit with maskless people every day I work. TriMet Security only cares about people who might ride without paying fare. They won't do zip about mask holes. I like that term, mask holes. Yeah, I would just say, you know, there should be a mandate to wear a mask on public transit. And, you know, people that think that's fascist, I think it's pretty destructive to expose people when they don't have to be exposed to the virus. And then, yeah, the public transit should be free. We need to get people on public transit, use less cars, you know, put the money into subsidizing public transit instead of roads, highways, and the automobile industry. So.
Amy, I'm so sorry. This is just something that breaks my heart every single day because we don't, working people take public transportation. Yes, it should absolutely be free. There should be an abundance of it. But also in the short term, it does not take a lot to enforce mask wearing. If my advice to you, which I'm sure you're already doing, the best mask, you should be wearing the best mask while you're on public transportation. So an N95 mask is going to give you the highest protection. An N95 mask also needs to be, the fit needs to be tight so that air can't get in. And you should also not, you should make sure that you hydrate or eat a snack beforehand, because once you take that mask off, if for any reason, that exposes you. Obviously, it's much better, as we all know, if both people or everybody is wearing a mask. But in the instance where we're not protecting each other with masking policies and enforcement of masking policies, and you have to be exposed, I encourage you to invest in a high quality N95 mask that fits really well to give yourself the maximum individual protection.
Psychology. COVID's been going for 4 calendar years now. It seems like it. I think it's a little bit less than that, and shows no signs of going away anytime soon. I got my 2 vaccine dosages and the booster and wear a mask, and still we're dealing with it. When does it end?
I wish I had a crystal ball to look into the future and tell you, but I don't. But what I can share with you is this. You know, we will get through this. We need to be prepared for situations like the Omicron variant, where we are going to have surges until things stabilize. And we also need to be thinking about this moment about as a massive disruptor. You know, think about this in tech terminology. They're always talking about disruptions to the market in order to create kind of new ways of thinking. COVID is a mass disruptor. And from a policy and a people opportunity, that means it's going to take all of us raising our voices for building the type of world that we want to live in post-COVID. But I don't think for quite sometime further, it's going to ever be like it was in, say, January of 2019, before any of us ever knew about COVID. But we will, as the world kind of slowed down, the world will also slowly pick back up. And in this transitional phase that we're in, I think it's really essential that we do everything in our power to protect one another, to stand for our rights to a safe working environment, safe learning environment, and also point out the real injustices that we're seeing happening in real time. This pandemic, as I'm sure you've heard and have thought about yourself, exposed every single fissure in our social fabric. This is our opportunity to make sure that that doesn't get buried again.
Yeah, I would say we end the pandemic when we end vaccine apartheid, when the world can get vaccinated. And Jill Stein and I and some other Greens put out a news release a few weeks ago that showed all the ways the U.S. government, the Biden administration, could end vaccine apartheid. Public Citizen figured it would take $25 billion to vaccinate the world. That's a fraction of the Pentagon budget. It's like 1/30th of it. The Biden administration has legal authority to take over the vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna. I think it's Moderna. They, you know, government scientists co-developed it. So the patent, you know, the government should have the patent, not just Moderna, if I have the right company. Maybe I think it was Moderna. There are provisions in the Defense Production Act where they could take the vaccine and make it available. There are provisions in 2 patent laws. And we put this all in the news conference. And Biden has said twice, last spring and again in November, right before the World Trade Organization was supposed to meet, that meeting got canceled because of COVID, that he was for lifting the vaccine patents. But then we got documents leaked out of the intellectual property, you know, group of the World Trade Organization where the U.S. was not supporting lifting the mandates. So, you know, that's what we got to push for. Fortunately, and there is, I think we may be able to get up a link to an article that was in The Guardian about a new vaccine out of Baylor and I think it's the Houston Children's Hospital, that the designers say, we're not patenting this. We want the world to have it available. But they need U.S. government support to scale up production and get it around the world. And the U.S. government is not providing that. In other words, the Biden administration is providing cover for Big Pharma, which has made tens of billions of dollars of profits off these vaccines instead of providing them at cost. That's why we have the Global South. There was one figure in our news release. In the last year, only 1% of the vaccines went to the poor, the low-income countries. So, and as long as the virus can run wild in the poor parts of the world, it's going to keep throwing up new variants and it'll come back and get us.
That's so, exactly right.
You know, that's what we got to do. We got to get that vaccine out there. And it's a public health emergency. The public should pay for it. It should be at cost, not at the super monopoly profits that Pfizer and Moderna are making. And, you know, that's an issue that, you know, we've tried to raise in the Green Party. It's raised a little bit by some of the Democrats, but it's not been a key issue in the middle of a, you know, public health emergency. That's very frustrating.
That's exactly right. We should be throwing every single tool at really lowering the barriers to access for developing mid-developed countries to be able to access not only vaccines from here in the US, but to build up capacity within their own countries to be able to produce those vaccines and get them out to people as soon as possible. And look, it's completely within our realm of possibility to do so. And I absolutely agree that it's an issue that some folks are following, but not enough. And I think part of the reason why is because, you know, we're just still unable to get our numbers under control here in the United States. And I think at this point in the pandemic, we have to be able to be disciplined enough to walk and chew gum at the same time. We need multiple priorities to keep our people safe, but also to do the right thing on a global scale.
Martha Kelly, why don't we hear much about the J&J vaccine anymore?
Great question, Martha. You know, I the J&J vaccine was only one original dose. And then it was found over the course of time that it was less strong against the Delta and Omicron variants. So the booster shot here in the U.S. for both Moderna and Pfizer was 6 months. And for J&J, it was 2 months, so a much more narrow window. So now the focus has been just on bringing more of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines online because they are a little bit stronger.
Well, we're coming up on an hour. Did we get that article? Yeah, the article from The Guardian's up there. So that'll tell you about that vaccine out of Texas. So Kristen, we're at the end of the hour. So is there anything more that you'd like to, you know, share with people and or ask them to do?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I just appreciate the conversation, Howie. I hope we can have another one again. And I encourage folks to continue to stay vigilant and get involved. Please follow us. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Our website is markedbycovid.com. And, you know, we have Zoom meetings very frequently for folks who've been impacted by the virus and folks who just want to help. So there are opportunities to get plugged in to raising some good trouble on this important work.
Well, thank you, Kristen, for coming on. I think, we learned a lot. I learned some. And, this pandemic's still with us. I mean, people are getting tired of it, but we haven't done what we need to do to stop it and protect the people. So this work continues.
Exactly right.
And, I hope people out will advocate and support those, workers who are teachers, nurses, fast food workers who are saying, we need protection. They need solidarity from us. And then going back to, what I said at the top of the hour about inclusive democracy, it's, voter access to the ballot is obviously important, but so is candidate access to the ballot. So the voters have all their choices. Mm-hmm. And we have a very exclusionary democracy. It's rooted in the single member district plurality system where, whoever gets the plurality gets all the representation. It's winner take all. So it's not just Greens or Libertarians or other third party or independent people. It's people in a major party that's a minor party in a particular district. And most districts are one party districts. 90% of congressional districts and 95% of state legislative districts in this country are overwhelmingly one party or the other. So they're not real elections. We already know who's going to win. That's why a lot of people don't vote.
Right.
I mean, we're in a situation where it doesn't matter how we vote. We're going to have the same representation that doesn't represent us. So that's why we need to advocate for fair ballot access. So all our candidates are on the ballot. Ranked choice voting for executive offices. So you can vote for who you want without helping your worst enemy. Mm-hmm. And proportional representation in legislative bodies. This is what an inclusive democracy means. It's not just, good things like no excuse absentee balloting and so forth. It also means you have all your choices on the ballot. So I hope Greens will make that a big issue as we go forward. And, last thing I'll say is, we seem to be peaking. That's what they're telling us with the Omicron virus. But, get that N95 or KN95 mask and wear it when you're out. Do follow the public health measures because we want people to be healthy and not dealing, with COVID, particularly if you get long COVID. You may be knocked out for even your whole life. So, take this seriously and take care of yourself. And thanks for coming today, and we'll see you next week. And thank you, Kristen, for being with us.
Thanks again.